Support comes from St. Louis Public Library Foundation, helping the library serve children and their families with programs and services needed to become lifelong readers. More information about the foundation is at slpl.org.
This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha.
And to do a cover-up, you just have to pretend that things aren't the way that they are. Patients in Ward 4 East are dying at a rate that is abnormal.
Is Richard Williams just the unluckiest nurse who has ever lived?
If you can't contain this, you know, Joseph, and you can't keep the FBI out of this, you're going to get fired.
Treated these mysterious deaths as an HR problem.
Jake Edelstein grew up in Columbia, Missouri. He moved to Japan in the early 90s, becoming immersed in a world of organized crime and struggled to fit in as the first non-Japanese reporter at a Japanese newspaper. Jake Edelstein's memoir of this time, titled Tokyo Vice, inspired an HBO series of the same name, with Jake played by actor Ansel Elgort. But Jake Edelstein's latest project, the podcast Night Shift, is taking a much different approach. As it turns out, while Jake Edelstein was getting acclimated to the violence and mystery of early 1990s Japan, something was happening back in his hometown of Columbia. Jake's father, Eddie Edelstein, worked as a pathologist at a veterans hospital there. In 1992, he faced the terrifying possibility that there was a serial killer on the loose. The mystery was connected to a pattern of suspicious deaths in a single ward of the Harry S. Truman Memorial Veterans Hospital.
He came to me and said, "This guy is murdering people." And I said, "I wouldn't use the word murder yet." Like, I said, maybe he's just the best nurse. Maybe he's taking care of the sickest people. So they went back and did it again. And the people that died weren't the sickest people. They were people getting ready to go home.
That's Eddie Edelstein speaking on the second episode of the new podcast series Night Shift, describing what it was like as doctors and nurses worked desperately to find out what was happening in their own hospital. The podcast is hosted by Jake Edelstein, and as he describes in the podcast, a nurse was eventually charged with 10 counts of murder, only for the prosecution to later fall apart, leaving the nurse to walk free before trial. Jake Edelstein is still reporting from his home in Tokyo, Japan. Earlier this month, he spoke with St. Louis on the Air producer Danny Wisentowski. They talked about the new podcast, the involvement of Jake's father in the case more than 30 years ago, and why he still believes that this story isn't over. Danny began by asking Jake to introduce us to his father, pathologist Eddie Edelstein, and what was happening in his life at the start of this case in 1992.
Well, you know, my father is a very eccentric individual. He grew up in the St. Louis, and we moved to a farm, in Columbia, Missouri, on the outskirts near McBain, Missouri. And, you know, in 1992, I was in Japan studying, interning as a journalist at the largest newspaper there, and he was running the Department of Pathology. He's a very easygoing guy. And on and off, he has been the medical examiner of Boone County. So, you know, he is not unfamiliar with death. And as someone who deals with death all the time, you know, he's sort of very stoic about it, because obviously you can't get emotionally involved if you're constantly dealing with bereaved people or horrible deaths, sometimes deaths which are not natural. And in, 92, he is the chief of pathology at the Harry S. Truman Hospital, and the chief of staff goes on vacation, and he says to my father, hey, Eddie, there's Earl Dick was the chief of staff. And he's like, "Hey, Eddie, there's some nurses talking about surgeon deaths on Ward 4 East, and they're saying it might be connected to this one nurse. So could you have a look at this while I'm gone?"
This is really where you start to pull these threads together in your first episode. And just tell us a bit, you know, you've mentioned the Harry S. Truman Hospital and this particular ward. Tell us a bit more about this hospital and, you know, as you said, these are veterans. These are people who are members of the military. What was it like to work there? And what did you learn about what it was like to work in this particular ward?
I remember volunteering at the VA hospital one summer, and it was kind of Spartan, but very clean, kind of drab. And, you know, I think my father, who isn't in really dealing with patients face-to-face, he's a pathologist. That means he's looking at slides, tissue samples, or looking to people when they're dead. I mean, his interaction with the patients was minimal, right? He's just analyzing the data or looking when things go wrong. So I've been through, I've interviewed people who were there at the time, nurses and doctors and physicians. And, you know, starting in early 1992, there are an increasing number of what are called code blues in the hospital. And those aren't usual things. A code blue is basically, if you're in a hospital, you might hear them call it. Code blue is someone is dying or is dead and they're going to try to resuscitate them, all hands on deck, just like in a TV show, an ER, you got the people with the paddles to revitalize the heart and maybe they're going to pump adrenaline in. It's a big deal. And it's very frenetic and it's very chaotic. And it happens maybe once every couple weeks, except on Ward 4 East. And a lot of these code blues are happening during the night shift. And with an increase of these numbers of code blues, that's the first thing that sets off alarm. Why are there so many of these emergencies? Why are there so many people getting, you know, violently ill at night and often dying?
So this mystery, the code blues, what's happening on Ward 4 East, you actually describe it that a rumor of an angel of death, you know, is part of the way that it's first described, that perhaps this might be an act of mercy, you know, reaching for reasons to explain this mystery. So what was it that really triggered this suspicion to go from rumors to your dad being approached and given this assignment to solve it?
I think it was that one of the things that really set things off was the death of Leo Yamri, who had come in. You know, Leo had been in the Army, I think, as a cook. I think he cooked for, like, you know, thousands of people. And, you know, when someone isn't expected to die and they're in good health and they suddenly, you know, can't be saved, that raises alarms. And Leo Yamri's nurse was, you know, this one individual named Richard Williams, who had been working in the hospital for a couple years, but had only recently been put in charge of Ward 4 East. So he was sort of the head nurse on some of these shifts. And Nurse Sally, around the time that Leo Yamri dies, she is so certain that this nurse, that Richard Williams, is perhaps killing patients, perhaps, you know, giving them euthanasia, that she checks to see what his insulin levels are, because one way to kill patients and not detect it is you give them an insulin overdose. And there's one disturbing thing that everybody realizes. The code blues are increasing. They're only increasing significantly in Ward 4 East, and the patients in Ward 4 East are dying at a rate that is abnormal.
How did scientists like your father actually try to tackle this issue? Because they were not, you know, hard-boiled detectives getting people in interrogation rooms. They were looking at their patients and trying to see, is something so out of line that we have to take action? How did he approach this? Your father, again, Eddie Adelstein, who is the chief of pathology at the hospital at the time.
Oh, he's still the chief of pathology there.
Still there.
I mean, yeah, I know. Yes, he's still at the VA hospital. He's still in the same office. My father will never retire, and he's still sharp as a tack. So, yeah, that may surprise you. Yes, he's still at the VA hospital. You know, my father's not a stats guy. But, you know, Gordon Christensen, who is a wonderful epidemiologist, he asked Gordon and Linda McGarry, who is in charge of quality improvement, to analyze the data and see if there's anything to these rumors. I think that the conclusion was that this number of deaths could be occurring with this one particular nurse at these times was 1,000 to 1 in the original statistical analysis. But that's because the template didn't let you go higher than 1,000. I mean, basically the formula they were using, you know, sort of, I'm not very good at math, clocks out at 1,000. But later analysis was like, well, the odds that you have all these patients dying connected to this one nurse on this one ward are about 1,000,000 to 1. And one of the things that's interesting is I got to know Gordon really well over the years. I even helped edit his science fiction book before he died. Is that, you know, Gordon mentions that when talking to the eventually this case, the police are called in, the FBI is called in, and he talks about, you know, going over the statistics with the special agents and how long it takes them for it to suddenly dawn on them that, like, yeah, there is no natural explanation for these things happening. You don't have 50 people dying in one ward as opposed to other wards in this short span of time without something really suspicious going on.
So this nurse, Richard Williams, he is, you know, in many ways the central focus of this story, and he is, of course, a free man. He has not been convicted of these crimes. What portrait of this person came into clarity as you continued talking to people and looking into who he is? Who was Richard Williams? Who is he?
Well, you know, Richard Williams is a small town guy who marries another nurse he meets in his early medical career. Very early on, even before he goes to the VA, he has a problem at one of the facilities that he's working in because he's accused of not giving the patients the medication he is supposed to give them and falsifying records. But he still gets hired at the VA hospital. He is described as a kind of ghostly figure. He is very pale, prematurely balding, with a kind of white streak in his hair. Some people describe him as being, some people describe him as being incredibly compassionate and caring and enthusiastic and quick to do his job, while others describe him as being someone who did what he was told, didn't do more than that, preferred to work alone at night, unobserved, and always seemed to be the first one at the scene when there was a code blue, you know, when the code blue was called, which is very exciting, you know. He is the first person to there. He is the person to save the patient, so to speak. Except sometimes he doesn't save the patient and they die. You don't find people talking about him being charismatic or charming, but, you know, sort of just there. And that's intriguing because he's sort of this blank slate.
Something that really struck me as the podcast describes who Richard Williams was, we learn a couple of incidents that really stand out. And one of them is actually a moment where he is accused by another physician who is there in this interaction where the other physician tells him, why are you killing my patients? Or stop killing my patients.
Right, right.
And what is amazing is that it sounds like this actually creates another official investigation and treating this like an HR issue where Richard Williams is saying, how dare someone accuse me? And he is defending himself. This is a very surreal series of events, considering that Richard Williams will eventually be charged for killing 10 people and then that those charges will be dropped. What did you learn from these sort of internal investigations and actually ones that treated these mysterious deaths as an HR problem in a way?
So about 2 weeks before Dad orders the initial investigation into what's happening on Ward 4 East, there is a young doctor, an intern doctor named Dr. Alkalani, and one of his patients dies. And he confronts Williams and he says, you know, Richard, why are you killing my patients? Do you not like me? Do you have an issue with me? And, you know, he is saying what is on the mind of everybody there, except he actually loses his temper and he says it. And Richard Williams reports this to his superiors. The director of the hospital, Mr. Kurzieski, who everyone calls Mr. K, Joseph Kurzieski, decides that they're going to have an investigation. And he appoints three people to be on a board of investigation. And the purpose of this, you know, inquiry is to basically, discover whether it was appropriate or inappropriate for the doctor to have made this comment.
So it's not about the deaths. It's the comment.
No. It's the comment. And what is interesting is as they are looking into this, you know, inappropriate behavior or alleged inappropriate by Dr. Alkalani, they begin to realize that, wait a second, it really does look like there are a lot of deaths clustered around Richard Williams. But that is not the scope of their investigation. And at one point, having heard that Dr. Christensen is working on a statistical analysis of the surge in code blues and deaths on this ward, they ask the director to see that data, and they are denied. And they both told me that they realized that they are not being allowed to do the job that they're supposed to do. And in fact, it seems to be that what they are being asked to do is to bury this case, to find, no cause for Kalani making a statement, to discipline him and not to dig any deeper. And when they try to dig deeper to see if, like, what if Kalani is right? What if Richard Williams is actually killing patients? They're shut down.
We need to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Jake Adelstein, the host of the new true crime podcast series, Night Shift. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. Welcome back. I'm Elaine Cha. Let's return to our conversation with journalist Jake Adelstein. He's the host of the new true crime podcast, Night Shift, that investigates a pattern of suspicious deaths in a hospital in Columbia, Missouri in the early 1990s. Jake Adelstein spoke with St. Louis on the Air producer, Danny Wisentowski.
I'm curious, you spend a lot of time kind of bringing the listener into this hospital, into these wards, and like into this tension between these physicians trying to figure out, why is the hospital treating these deaths like this? Is Richard Williams just the unluckiest nurse who has ever lived? Is he just being there with particularly sick patients? All of these people contending with maybe this, maybe that. I feel this way, but perhaps there's an explanation. What was it like to, I think, listen to people weighing their suspicions against this person when the stakes were so high?
I am impressed, actually, that in a culture where there was so much pressure to pretend that nothing happened, that that there were people who stood up and said, "No, you have to get this guy away from the patients." Dr. Swaney and Dr. Swaney and Lee Miller, who was an RN at the time, they are thwarted in their efforts to do what they want to do But let me read you for the final report and what they wrote in their recommendations, because they're doing, you know, this is what they are saying at the time, and this was what was basically ignored. The increased incidence of code blues and deaths on Ward 4 East, and particularly Mr. Williams' involvement in a disproportionate number of them, must be pursued rigorously. This board believes such a review must include issues such as expected and unexpected nature of the deaths, number of code blues and deaths at which Mr. Williams was the first respondent compared to other staffs, times of death, witnessed versus unwitnessed, initial findings of code blue team, policy changes which may have contributed to increased deaths, and so on. Because of the already pervasive nature of rumors concerning Mr. Williams among nursing staff, which we believe have been magnified by his reassignment outside of nursing service, the board recommends that he not be returned to a patient care assignment until completion of the reviews and analysis and recommendation and any subsequent reviews or investigations which might be warranted. That's pretty strong language. And despite this board reaching these conclusions and giving this report to the director, until the story breaks and is reported by the Columbia Daily Tribune, he was making every effort to return Richard Williams to patient care. And this is one reason that Dr. Christensen was kind of going bonkers, because he clearly sees the danger, and he's concerned about patients. And as far as he can tell, the director of the hospital just wants to move on.
You mentioned Dr. Gordon Christensen. He's the epidemiologist who was working, you know, with your father, Eddie Adelstein, who were both kind of witnessing this. What does your father talk about when you ask him about this time? He's watching his colleague stand up to the hospital, try to do the right thing. Richard Williams is still in the mix, and on some level, there's still no clear answer for why someone would do this or how it's being done. What is it like for your father at this moment?
Well, my father is, here he is. He's the chief of staff. He's not the normal chief of staff. He's the acting chief of staff, right? And when Gordon comes back to him with this data, he's like, okay, we're moving this guy off of Ward 4 East immediately. It doesn't matter whether it's true or not. It is creating so much havoc and so much worry, and there is significant statistical evidence that can suggest that this is dangerous to the patients and perhaps certainly not good for Williams' career. We're going to move him away. But then the chief of staff comes back, and then there is a huge tug of war between Mr. Kurzyeski, Gordon Christensen, the chief of staff at Earl Dick, and my father, who are saying, you have to, you know, move this guy out of all patient care, and you need to call in the FBI. This is not something that we can investigate. This is beyond our powers. You need to bring in the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And there is incredible resistance from the director. It's hard for me to sympathize with Mr. Kurzyeski, who is no longer on this planet, but there's an interesting interaction at one point. My father is in the room with Kurzyeski, and Kurzyeski is on the phone with one of the top VA administrators. And on that phone call, which is on a speakerphone, the person above Kurzyeski in the VA food chain says to him, you know, do you really want to call in the FBI? Because the last time we did this, we had to fire the chief of staff and the director. And Kurzyeski is on the verge of retirement. And I think that implied threat that, you know, if you can't contain this, you know, Joseph, and you can't keep the FBI out of this, you're going to get fired, was enough to really spark the beginning of a cover-up. And to do a cover-up, you just have to pretend that things aren't the way that they are.
At some point, the FBI becomes involved. And
right.
This does not solve this issue or make it any more clear at the time. What happens when the FBI gets involved? They take a particular approach to the way that they evaluate this case.
So the FBI comes in, you know, like the cavalry, and they do hundreds of interviews. They go through the records. They they exhumed 10, they exhumed 13 bodies, I think. Yeah, 13. They exhume these bodies. They take samples. They interview everyone. They interview everyone except actually Lee Miller, who is one of the nurses on this original board of inquiry, which I never understood why you would skip him, because he actually knew Richard Williams. They interview all these people, and then suddenly the case grinds to a halt. And the problem is that there's a time limit on this case. Homicide isn't FBI jurisdiction. So what is investigated, this case is investigated as a civil rights case. But civil rights violations only have a statute of limitations for 5 years. If you can't make your case within 5 years, it gets closed. You can't prosecute people. And in this case, you know, the first 2 years, the FBI seems to be doing a great job. They somehow missed the fact that Richard Williams moves on to a nursing home in Ashland, where five times the normal number of people die in a 10-month period. And then everything stops. They basically send the families of the veterans a note saying, hey, we tried our best to investigate, but time ran out. Everything's done.
One thing that I do want to address, and I think, you know, by now, there are between 40 and 70 suspicious deaths associated with him. And, you know, that the fact that he was allowed to move on, to leave the VA and just go work at this nursing home is still kind of just startling to me.
Well, the fact that Richard Williams, who is associated with 40 plus deaths, is given a letter of recommendation by the Veterans by the Harry S. Truman VA, and then goes to work at a nursing home in Ashland, where the number of deaths quadruples during the time he's there, is mind-boggling. It is also mind-boggling to me that the FBI, who is investigating him for these events at the VA hospital, doesn't bother to sort of check in on him at the nursing home in Ashland. I mean, there's no evidence that they seem to even be aware that he was working there or that the number of deaths was increasing. And I don't know why that would be. It would certainly seem to me that if you were building a case and looking at all these things, that you'd want to be keeping an eye on the guy.
You know, this entire case, you know, starting in 1992, it continues over really the next decade. And he is charged with 10 counts of first-degree murder in 2002. But about only a year later or so, he's released after prosecutors admit that their evidence is somehow flawed after all that. Could you just, in summary, tell us how this case against Richard Williams, after dozens and dozens of deaths are associated with him, after all the thing the nurses and doctors like your father and Gordon Christensen try to prove, how does he walk free?
Okay. So there is a time when it looks like this case is completely closed, and there is a civil trial in which a federal judge, Judge Nanette Lowry, ruling on a wrongful death lawsuit by the families of one of the veterans, rules that the VA hospital was negligent in not monitoring Richard Williams, and I'm quoting the verdict, the preponderance of the evidence is that he killed Elsie Havram, one veteran, and that the VA knew that it was a possibility and didn't prevent it. And the family is awarded $450,000. The government appeals. They lose that one. And it sort of lights a fire under the ass of the FBI and the authorities. So the investigation sort of continues. And around 2002, you know, Kevin Crane, who is the prosecutor at the time, is contacted by the laboratory that works for the FBI, and they say, we have a new test that can find a chemical agent even in embalmed tissue, And this chemical agent, which we believe was used to kill these patients, succinylcholine, has been found in the tissue samples that we have. We have the murder weapon. We've determined the murder weapon. And, you know, based on all the circumstantial evidence, and now that they have this new laboratory procedure, which can show that succinylcholine, which is commonly used in hospitals to sort of paralyze people before surgery at the time, was used to kill these patients. He's got a murder weapon. He's got the circumstances. He's got the stats. And they arrest Richard Williams on 10 counts of homicide. He does not get bail and is held in jail. And as they are building their case and getting ready to set a court date, someone comes back to Kevin Crane and says, hey, this procedure that we used to determine that succinylcholine was used to kill these veterans is flawed. As a matter of fact, it's so flawed that if we perform this test on steak that we buy at a supermarket, we can find succinylmonocholine, which is a byproduct of succinylcholine, in the steak. So basically, all your forensic evidence, you have the new laboratory test, don't work, and someone in Florida was just had their guilty verdict overturned because this new procedure designed by a guy named Dr. Ballard can't be replicated and isn't scientifically valid. And realizing that his whole case hinges on this idea that succinylcholine was used to kill the patients, and without being able to prove that, Kevin Crane drops the charges and Richard Williams goes free.
What did your father tell you about his reaction to this after spending years watching this case develop?
Well, my father he's a pathologist, and he said, you know, your tests don't make any sense. I don't think that is I don't think that, you know, your new methods will stand up in court, essentially. So he isn't horribly surprised when it all falls apart, but he is of the opinion that, you know, that if they had done the job better and earlier, that they could have probably made the case. But, you know, Kevin Crane is a good prosecutor. I mean, he's a good prosecutor on this case. And, you know, his point is that if you try someone for murder, you only get one shot. And if they're found innocent, because we have double jeopardy, which doesn't really kind of exist in Japan, and you screwed up, well, you'll never be able to put that person on trial again, right? That's how our legal system works. And feeling that he couldn't prove the case beyond the shadow of a doubt, what else is he going to do except drop the charges and hope that maybe someday someone can, using different evidence, do it right?
So let me ask, you know, this case, you know, it's been developing for more than 30 years. You spend a great deal of time, a lot of reporting with your reporting partner, talking to these physicians, talking to nurses,
talking to families,
even hearing from, you know, archival clips of Richard Williams himself maintaining his innocence. I guess the question is, you know, he has been out, you know, this case has not had substantial legal developments. Why look at this case now, you know, in 2024, so many years later? And what are these families and physicians and folks like your father hoping could develop from this?
I mean, the families want closure. The Havram families are the only family that has gotten closure in some sense, in that a federal judge told them, yeah, you were right. Your father was murdered. Terribly sorry. Here is, here is the compensation that you deserve. But realize that isn't enough. My feeling about this is that everybody who knows this case is getting older, and Dr. Christensen has passed away. Dr. Earl Dick has passed away. But when you look at this evidence, and especially you look at the Havram case, you know, I believe that the case could be made, that this case could be tried. It's never been tried, not in criminal court. And I would hope that maybe, with renewed interest in this, that people might go back to the evidence that hopefully is still on file, hopefully still frozen in a locker somewhere. And with modern forensic methods and the way that science keeps developing on these things, that maybe they could reinvestigate and find out what really happened. I can't conceive of another cause of this, of these 40 deaths, other than the principal suspect. Though when going through the FBI transcripts and going through, you know, hundreds and hundreds of documents, there certainly were one or two other suspects in the case of this investigation. None of them seem like substantial suspects, but, you know, it's a world of infinite possibilities. What everyone hopes, I think, is that this is reinvestigated and that it is done right. And maybe we weren't, and maybe it would be nice to learn, why did the FBI not do the job that they should have done? Why did they put off doing the forensic test for years? Why did they sort of let the whole case fall apart and the statute of limitations pass and leave it in limbo for years? I would love to have answers to that, but none of the FBI agents who worked on that case will talk to me on the record. Wayne Kessler, who was the special investigator for the Veterans Hospital, seems like a great guy. All I could get out of him was a text message, which is, I'm no longer comfortable talking about this case, and I can't have anything to do with it. I have my reasons. So there are a number of mysteries that the families have, that my father has, that Dr. Christensen had when he died, that would be nice to get clarity on. And hopefully this podcast spurs even the VA hospital to re-examine what happened and try and give the world a more satisfying conclusion.
That was journalist Jake Adelstein. He spoke last month to St. Louis on the Air producer Danny Wisentowski. Jake is the host of the new podcast series, Night Shift. It released its fourth episode this weekend.
This episode was produced by Danny Wisentowski.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.